For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm very happy to have with us this evening Stephen Hine, who is the preeminent Western scholar of Dogen and also a scholar of Zen koans and the Zen tradition in many aspects. So thank you for coming again to speak with us, Stephen.
Okay, well, thank you, Taigen, for inviting me here once again. Congratulations that you'll be celebrating a 10-year anniversary. There's not going to be a quiz on this handout, but there's a lot of materials here. What I want to try to do is get to the essence of it, which is going to be to discuss several kinds of Zen poetry by Dogen and by some of the some of his colleagues and successors in his lineage. And let me talk a little bit about the role of poetry in Zen Buddhism at the time of Dogen, which is the first half of the 13th century. And Dogen went to China in the 1220s for 4 years. And there's a little tiny map here on the first page. I realized it got compressed. I had some formatting issues when I was printing this out. But anyway, you can see that Dogen went to the eastern seaboard of China in the 1220s for 4 years, 1223 to 1227. He went to an area near Shanghai, a little south of Shanghai. Shanghai did not exist at that time, but there were several important port cities that were prominent in China, including the famous city of Hangzhou. That was a city where Marco Polo had visited, would visit later that century, actually, and declare that it was the most spectacular city in the world. And Hangzhou was the capital of China, and it was a very advanced cultural phenomenon and literary city. And the writing of poetry and the playing of music and other kinds of visual literary and other kinds of art forms was very crucial to the cultural development in China. And because of those reasons, it began to play a very big role in Zen Buddhism and very much affected Dogen and his followers. Now, let me cite a passage from Dogen's famous book, Shobogenzo, Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. In one of the lesser-known chapters or fascicles, he called Do Shin, which means the mind of the way, or the mind that seeks the way, or the way-seeking mind. He says that if you want to practice the way of the Buddha, first of all, you have to cultivate the mind of the way, or the mind that seeks the way. And the cultivation of that mind often involved, for Dogen and for many other Zen monks, the writing of poetry and also other kinds of art forms. Now, they realized there was a kind of tension because meditation is silent and thoughtless, and the writing of poetry could be considered something artificial and something that would detract from the meditative state of mind. On the other hand, the meditative state of mind closely resembled the artistic level of awareness that it took to write a great poem. And it could be seen that poetry and meditation enhanced one another, but it was never a clear-cut picture. And one of the interesting parts about the poetry is that they dealt with that very creative tension about whether poetry was something conducive or not to practicing meditation. Now, when I'm talking about this period of poetry, it really encompassed about 300 or 400 years in China and Japan, beginning around the year 1000 in China, and then going into the 1200s when Dogen goes to China and brings Zen back to Japan, and then for a couple hundred more years in Japan. Now, we know that Dogen is considered the founder of the Soto Zen sect in Japan at that time, and the other main Zen sect that was brought over from China to Japan was known as Rinzai Zen sect. And if you read most of the books on the history and literature of Zen Buddhism that are available in English, including some outstanding books, almost all of them are going to tell you that poetry was the expertise of the Rinzai Zen Buddhist school, and that Soto Zen school didn't participate very much in poetry, if at all. And there is some truth to that, that the Rinzai Zen school was primarily located in the capital city of Kyoto. And like the city of Hangzhou in China, Kyoto was a very literate and very advanced cultural milieu where to become a leader in society, you had to be a literati. You had to be somebody who engaged in the arts. And so since Rinzai Zen was in that environment, it was natural that Rinzai Zen would produce a lot of poetry because that was a way to communicate with the literati, to win them over, to persuade them to practice meditation, and to inspire them to greater literary achievement. Dogen started in Kyoto, but moved to the fairly remote mountain area where it was not populated by the literati, although some of them did accompany him to the mountains. And so Dogen isn't really included in the poetry, and certainly after Dogen, the followers after Dogen are lesser accounted for in the history of the poetry collections of that period. So, you know, one of the things that Zen Buddhism likes to do generally is to defeat stereotypes and overcome false assumptions and make and challenge misleading concepts. And I think what we can find, there's a lot of examples where in looking at some of the history, we can apply some of the Zen methodology of challenging the stereotypes in a similar way by questioning, was that really true to form or not? Now, if you look at the top of the handout on the first page, you know, midway down, and again, the formatting got a little bit skewed here, but basically what I tried to do is create a chart that would track the poetry Dogen wrote, primarily in what they call Sino-Japanese, or it's a kind of hybrid form of Chinese and Japanese. And he it was one style of poetry, and he also wrote poetry in the strictly Japanese style. That was another kind of poetry, and he wrote both styles, but he primarily wrote the hybrid Sino-Japanese style. Almost all of those poems are translated in the masterful work that Taigen and Shohaku Okumura produced, called Dogen's Extensive Record. So you can find translations of those poems. And a few of them exist outside of that work. And as you can see, there's grand total is about 449 hybrid style or Chinese Sino-Japanese style poems. So that's quite a considerable number. And they were written over different periods of his life, and they were written in different genres within that general style. 450. You know, is no small number. So that immediately defeats some of the stereotype that Soto Zen and Dogen's form of Zen shouldn't be associated with poetry. When we look at it from another angle, it's pretty obvious that Dogen was going to write a lot of poetry, because when he went to China, that's what the Zen monks were doing. And he comes back from China to Japan, and he's trying to introduce this material. So he they didn't only write poetry, of course. Dogen introduces meditation, and he introduces the monastic rules, and he introduces many other features of Zen life. But poetry was certainly a crucial part of it. He wrote poems that were commentaries on koans. He wrote poems that were eulogies for the previous ancestors in the tradition. He wrote poems about his own state of mind. He wrote poems celebrating nature. And he wrote poems for other ceremonial occasions, for memorials, for deceased colleagues, and on and on. The you know, how great they the poetry was as poetry is one of the interesting things that it's hard to assess, because if you go into the studies within the Japanese world, both within the Soto sect and within universities where you have researchers looking at this historical material, they usually divide up, okay, this is the literary poetry and this is the religious poetry, and we don't really expect the religious poetry to be quite as good as literature as literary poetry. And that's another stereotype that builds up. That's a complicated point that is beyond our scope this evening. But what I do want to say is that Chinese poetry had many strict rules. Most poetic traditions, you know, like Shakespeare's sonnets, for example, there's certain strict rules that you have to follow in terms of, in Chinese, in terms of rhyme schemes, in terms of the tonal patterns, and in terms of how you structure each line, and what kind of imagery you put into it, what it sounds like, and how you have to create a kind of indirection or elusive quality so that you don't say too much that's literal in the words, and you leave a lot to the imagination of the reader. And we can say that Dogen did learn how to and did follow those patterns. Whether he did it super well or not, that's a judgment that it's hard to make one way or the other. But did he learn how to do the poetry and follow it the right way? Yes. In fact, we can see that even though Dogen was, of course, speaking Japanese, and maybe he didn't speak Chinese that well, he must have used guidebooks or manuals that he picked up to show the rhyme schemes. And you can actually have a website today where you can take Dogen's poetry in the Chinese characters and cut and paste it into the website, and it'll tell you, it'll show you, and I have a couple examples of this in the handout, it'll show you whether or not the rhymes were working or not. And if you test that out with some of Dogen's poetry, you see in most cases he did follow that, and he was successful in it as best we can tell. So let's leap into one of the poems, and let's look at the one on the bottom of the first page. And so let me ask somebody to read that poem, please. Who would like to read that? Okay.
Living in the world for so long without attachments, since giving up using paper and pen, I see flowers and hear birds without feeling much. While staying on this mountain, I am embarrassed by my meager efforts.
Okay. So, you know, what I threw in there was the Chinese characters. You can see there's four lines with seven characters in the line. And then on the right-hand side of that, after the characters, that is showing the tonal patterns for each character. It gets kind of complicated. And then there's the romanization of the pronunciation process. And you can see, I think in this case, you have a rhyme with the end of the second line, lie, and the end of the last line, C-A-I or Tsai. So that's one example of how the poetry works. But let's look at the content of the poem. What is Dogen talking about here? What kind of attitude or feeling is he trying to express? Yeah. Okay, good, good. How do we know that his attachment to nature has been neutralized? Okay, good, good. So he's been living without attachments, and the sensation of smelling the flowers and hearing the birds singing, he's able to neutralize. He's able to not be overcome by some kind of too excited by those sensations. And is that good to get not excited by the sensations? Or should he appreciate them even more so? Now remember, there are a couple famous Zen stories there was a Chinese master who supposedly got enlightened when he saw peach blossoms blooming one spring day. There's another story where another Chinese master who had been struggling with trying to understand enlightenment for many months and many years. One day was sweeping and a pebble hit a bamboo tree, and the sound of that of the ping when the pebble hits the tree is said to awaken him. So and Dogen quotes those stories quite a bit. So in a certain way, sensations can be useful, but you know, it's good to overcome attachments, though, right? And so if it becomes a source of attachment, it's good to conquer it. Is Dogen satisfied with his conquering of those of that attachment, according to this poem?
I don't think so, anyways.
Yeah. Can you say a little more?
Yeah. While staying on this mountain, I'm embarrassed by my leader's efforts.
Right. Okay.
It seems like it's flipping the switch on.
Right. Right. Okay. Now, one of the things that the poems are supposed to do is, especially in the four-line poems, is that the first line introduces a theme. The second line develops the theme. The third line challenges the theme. And then the fourth line comes to some kind of conclusion, often ironic or paradoxical or seemingly contradictory to what's been said before. So we can see that pattern playing out pretty well here. Now, remember, readers are going to expect all these things to happen. So Dogen didn't invent those patterns, but then how is he bringing his own unique flavor to it? So he's not satisfied. Where is he left? Why wouldn't Dogen, who has accomplished so much spiritually and has cast off body mind early in his career and his, you know, developing this whole new Zen sangha in Japan, what can we say about his state of mind in this? Yeah.
He's self-critical.
Self-critical. Okay. And so self-criticism in itself becomes what?
Attachment.
Okay. Is self-criticism the attachment, or is self-criticism the overcoming of the attachment, even to the overcoming of attachment? You know, when Dogen cast off body mind, his teacher said, cast off casting off. So it's a continuing process. So, you know, what I'm trying to suggest is there's no clear conclusion. And I think great poetry in any tradition leaves it to the reader to make the judgment. But what Dogen is telling us, okay, well, let's ask this question. What is he embarrassed by? Meaning?
It's not his lack of achieving.
Okay, so one way to look at it is that he's embarrassed by his lack of achieving good poetry. Like, he says, maybe I can't live up to the nature that's around me. I can't put it into words successfully enough. Or maybe he's embarrassed by his meager effort, meaning, like, I haven't really overcome the attachment enough yet. I have to still, you know, I have this kind of tension with it. Now, from this, from a certain outlook of meditation, all of that ambivalence and uncertainty and kind of tension that he feels might be seem like a kind of deficiency. And look, if we look on page 2... near the top of page 2, Dogen had made a statement that is pretty well known in Soto Zen circles. Zen monks are fond of literature, finding it an aid to writing verses and tracts. This is a mistake. No matter how elegant their prose or exquisite their poetry might be, they are toying with words and cannot gain the truth. Now, why did he write 450 of them? there's one easy answer for that. What would the easy answer be? When I say easy, I don't mean it's a mistaken, but he said the negation of poetry in one context to a certain group of followers who maybe weren't sophisticated enough to deal with writing poetry, so he wanted to discourage them at that stage in their spiritual progression. But at another stage, or for another audience, or for another group of followers, he could write poetry and ask them to engage in the poetry and expect them to write the poetry. So that's it. That's a kind of easy solution, that he's targeting certain audiences. And it's hard for us to know which audience he had, you know, because we're, after 800 years, we're trying to recreate some of the context there. But I think it's pretty clear that Dogen, in this poem, is saying that the impulse to write, the impulse to try to create some creative discourse, try to create rhetoric that is conducive to understanding the spiritual awakening, is something that he wants to try to do, in spite of himself. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, Dogen, you know, and a lot of the Zen monks were great calligraphers. Dogen is prized in Japanese history for some of his calligraphy. And that was a talent that all the literati had, and to show you were well educated, and for the monks to show their, you know, artistic followers, hey, you know, we can perform well in this, is kind of taken for granted that something they had to do, but yet he's not attached to it. So he's given it up in the sense that he's not attached, but maybe through the non-attachment he can do it that much better, because he has a kind of free, he has the freedom to articulate in a way that that is enabled by the lack of attachment.
Are you saying that in the sense that by not being attached to the expensive pens and the expensive paper that is so often used as an art form.
Right.
By giving up all those accoutrements.
Accoutrements, yes. Right.
He's able now to
express
himself in a plainer, more direct.
That's right. And he says the same thing, you know, similar kinds of things about the Buddhist robe and other implements that are used in Zen ceremonies. You want to celebrate the use of them as a display of your enlightened state of mind, but as soon as they become attachment, a form of attachment, then you have to hold back from it. But you can't just hold back from it and negate it. So Dogen is a ceremonial, religious leader, I think. And I think you introduced the word expensive. It doesn't exactly say that, but that's the point, right? If it becomes an end in itself, just as a show-off piece. No, that's what you try to hold back from. But the idea of articulating, expressing, and, you know, one of his famous writings in Shobo Genzo is do toku, which means to, toku means to express the way. It's usually translated as expressing the way. That's part of cultivating that way-seeking mind. Right.
Just to portray it in literary form is the stain of defilement.
Yeah.
And that's just extremely funny, because you're reading this poem and that's what it's doing.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think the word, you know, a word for what you're saying is the irony, the deliberate use of irony that creates a certain humor. Yeah.
It's just inescapable. It
is inescapable, because when you're dealing at that level, there's going to seem to be contradictions. Not necessarily are contradictions, but you can't avoid a certain conflict from a human perception. So let's look at a couple of other examples. First of all, on that first page, I wanted to point out the. Let me go back to the first page. Next to the map, there's a little diagram from a Japanese collection of Dogen's poetry. And again, it's hard to see that size, but you can see the characters are there. You can see those arrows pointing to little boxes. And the point is that, you know, what they do in that collection is they take each poem, they show the original poetry, they translate it into modern Japanese, they write footnotes on it, they wrote comments on it, and this is kind of a roadmap to how you're going to read this book that has it, and it gets very, very complicated, because you really want to you know, like great literature in any tradition, you really want to break apart and analyze. And Dogen himself was known for applying the method to the Zen materials that he interpreted of, like, let's look at each word. And some people call that atomization. Like, let's take each word and phrase and examine it in its context, take it out of its context, turn it around, flip it upside down, take, you know, look at it from every possible angle. Here's another passage which comes from Dogen's extensive record. Ehe Koloku, naturally all knowledge is worthwhile, but why study Buddhist and Confucian classics? Solitary, silent, sitting meditation shows various ploys or undivided reality encompassing thousands of deceptions. So he uses the word ploys and deceptions. That, I think, there's where you get that kind of humor. So in a very articulate way, he's saying all my articulateness is a deception. But Dogen's the same person who says, life is a big mistake. It's one mistake on top of another mistake. And, you know, in modern Asia, that phrase, mistake on mistake, is often translated in modern Japanese as making the right mistake. You know, if you make enough mistakes, sometime the mistake is going to be the right one. And Dogen also says, disentangle tangled vines by using the entangled vines to disentangle themselves. Okay, so let's take a look at the middle of page 2. Now, this was one of Dogen's most famous poems, and this was written just a few years after he came back from China, before he set up his first main temple. So we have to feel that in the year 1231 or 1230, they have to feel that he was struggling somewhat with the idea that here I am and I'm trying to start a Zen community, but it's not quite happening yet. It will take place in a few years. He must have had a good sense that he had the capacity and he would develop, but at this point, maybe he's a little bit in despair. So who would like to read that one? How pitiful.
How pitiful is life and death ceasing and arising. I lose my way, yet find my path as if walking in a dream. Even though there are still things that are hard to forget, the deep grasp of Fukakusa settles in the sound of the evening rain.
Okay, now, Fukakusa, that word literally means deep grass. And at that time in Kyoto, this was an outlying kind of countryside district. Now it's been encompassed by the metropolitan sprawl of the city. But at that time, it was in the countryside, and it was known as kind of the leisure class place to go to have a getaway from the city and take your vacation there. And apparently Dogen was able to set up his hermitage in that area. What is the thing that is hard for him to forget in line 3? Now, I want to point out that this poem was one of the first poems that was ever translated into English by Lucian Strick back in, I think, the late 1960s or 70s. And I have his translation a few lines below, which I think is an interesting and inspiring translation in a lot of ways. It's not quite literal, perhaps, but I did want to show that. And you may have run across that in some of your readings. But let's go back to the third line. What is the thing that is hard to forget? So what would he wish to forget?
We can all speculate.
Okay, good. Yeah. Okay. So casting off, he wants to cast off, right. He wants to study the self to forget the self. That's one way to read that line. That's a good way to read that line. I think if we turn it, twist it around a little bit. Another way to read the line is that I want to remember something, which is my commitment to teaching, I think. That's the way I read it. In other words, I'm in my delusions, I'm in my awakening, I'm in the dream state, I'm in the enlightened state. I see life and death, and I see all this around me, but it's not about me. So that's the forgetting the self. And the forgetting the self is the commitment to transmit the Dharma. And then the final line, what does that offer?
The immediacy of the sound.
The immediacy of the sound, right. Right, immersion in the sound. And a lot of the Zen poetry, and especially Dogen's poetry, but other poems of that era, usually end the last line is some simple observation of nature and being enraptured in that moment of the natural surroundings, whether it's the clouds floating above the mountains or the rain on the roof or the sound of the rain driving through the fields.
That also be that, in spite of all his efforts, whether they're good or bad, the world still keeps on going.
Yes, and that's another way to look at it. So I have that commitment, but even that commitment, I have to forget or cast aside. If that commitment to transmit becomes another attachment, and just the world of evanescence, the world of coming and going, is going to happen one way or another, and we have to stand in awe. Look at the last poem here. This was written in a different era. This was written when Dogen was up in Heiji and up in the mountains. And apparently he would go off from the temple grounds at Heiji and find a hermitage, find a hut to meditate and write poetry there. And he would bring the paper and pen with him. And some of his best poems were written in that state of mind. How much joy I feel dwelling in this mountain hut, solitary and serene, every day spent deciphering the words of the Lotus Sutra, wholeheartedly sitting under a tree, what to make of love and hate, or what relevance do they have, what relevance do those dualities have here, listening to the sound of the evening rain, deepening that feeling of autumn, you know. So once again, we come back to that immediacy of that sensation. So, what do you think of Dogen's poetry so far?
I'm trying to figure out what distinguishes Zen poetry as opposed to other traditions, right? Traditions, even spiritual traditions. What are your thoughts?
Right. Okay. So, if I understood your question, is like what distinguishes this as Zen rather than just poetry, right? Well, okay. I mean, that's a very interesting point, actually. I like that point a lot, because the usual point people bring up is, like, what makes this poetry? Just the fact that he has seven characters, he's still writing Zen stuff, Wheeler, and it's not really literature. That's what the literary people would say. And that's why they don't pay that much attention to his poetry as poetry, for the most part. So the answer is somewhere in between. You know, but I think your question, you know, it's important to bring up that other perspective. Maybe Dogen didn't really want to write all those poems, but he couldn't help himself. Maybe that was a way, you know, that he knew that was an important way of transmission, because in the cultural environment, some people were going to be more responsive to that than other kinds of things. Now, I don't know how much time I have to... How much? Oh, okay. All right, good. Well, I want to come back to a couple more on this page, but I want to leap ahead to another topic. I know I'm covering a lot here, but I got excited recently, and I was talking to Taigen last night about this topic, which is what happened after Dogen died. His death is in 1253. And the Soto sect continued to develop after his death. And when it comes to this issue of literature and poetry, generally the thought is, well, okay, Dogen wrote a lot of poetry. From a literary standpoint, they don't really pay that much attention to it. They pay more attention to his other kinds of writings. But What happened after Dogen was that poetry dropped out of the picture almost altogether in Soto Zen, although it was maintained very emphatically in Rinzai Zen. That's what you're going to read in most of the historical material about that period. And so by the time you get into the 1300s, 50, 75 years after Dogen, several generations have gone by. There's been new leadership at Aheiji. Things have developed in various directions. And poetry, you know, didn't seem to be one of the ones that was important anymore. So the feeling would be that, well, Dogen wrote the poems because he learned that in China and he was trying to introduce the Chinese style into Japan. But once the style caught on, what they picked on was either meditation or other kinds of monastic activities and monastic rituals, and they kind of integrated it with some of the folklore and other ceremonial traditions in Japan at that time, and poetry wasn't so important. So I'm here to try to defeat that stereotype as well, because you know, what I've come to see is that there was a school of thought, a sub-school within the Soto Zen tradition, known as the Wanshi school, Wanshi Ha. Ha is Japanese for school or movement. And Wanshi is the Japanese pronunciation of a very famous Chinese monk several generations before Dogen, who was a Soto monk named Hongzhi. And in Hongzhi is the Chinese pronunciation, Wanshi is the Japanese pronunciation of Hongzhi's name, and it became known as the Wanshi school in Japan. And generally, if you read about this, little bits written in English about this, and they'll usually say, well, the Wanshi school is known for being a subsect of Soto Zen, but it really merged with Rinzai Zen because all they cared about was poetry. Poetry was Rinzai Zen, so don't really think of it as Soto Zen. So, what I want to say is that actually, there was a period in the 1300s where the Wanshi school was connected with Dogen's lineage, and it did uphold the idea that poetry was very important in transmitting the Dharma, and it was crucial to the Soto Zen tradition. And then, and maybe it died out later, or it took different forms later. But I want to try to introduce the idea that this Wanshi Ha, which developed about 100 years after Dogen, primarily with a new wave of Japanese monks who studied in China and brought poetic traditions back to Japan, was a crucial part of Dogen's lineage. Now, let's consider the gentleman known as Hongzhi or Wanshi. So at the top of page 3, here's a little table showing how many poems that Hongzhi actually wrote, and the grand total is... Here's the quiz. All right, you pass. All right. So, you know, over 2.5 times as much as Dogen wrote. So that's a lot of poetry. In fact, Hongzhi was considered, of all the great Chinese Zen poets, Hongzhi was considered probably the greatest of them all, not only because of quantity, but because of quality. And, you know, as Taigen has talked about in some of his writings, the idea of the five ranks or the five degrees of interconnection between, and there's different ways of articulating between crooked and straight or between absolute and relative, was one of the main teachings that was used by Hongzhi and other Chinese Soto Zen teachers. And what Hongzhi and others often did was to write poems that would use lyrical imagery, natural metaphors and allusions to embody the meaning of the relation between the straight and crooked or absolute and relative in terms of five degrees of connectedness. And in the middle of that page is one example showing the straight within the crooked. So what happens in a lot of this poetry is that it was used as a form to express spiritual ideas that that were hard to articulate in a direct way. And poetry being indirect, elusive, appealing to intuitive awareness rather than the logical mind, was considered a good way to communicate the Dharma. So it seems like the idea was that poetry is not really a distraction. It's not something to be embarrassed about. It's not something we should turn away from. It's not something that's just done because it's an easy way to appeal to literati. It's something that's used because you can express a deeper level of truth than you can in than the typical prose way. So, you know, when a famous saying is that Zen is a special transmission outside the ordinary teachings without reliance on words and letters. And that doesn't mean rejecting words and letters. That means don't rely. I mean, one way of interpreting that saying is that it means don't rely on ordinary words and letters, but use a very creative, specially inventive and innovative type of expression, which is found in poetry. So, you know, to try to make a long story short, what happened in the 1200s and 1300s was that after Dogen and some of the early pioneers or pilgrims who went to China from Japan and brought Zen back, then there was a wave of dozens and hundreds of monks actually traveling from Japan to China. And some monks came from China to Japan. And some monks stayed in China but taught Zen disciples, taught Japanese disciples. And some monks stayed in Japan but learned Chinese well enough to write great Chinese poetry. And it was a very dynamic period, and there were all kinds of levels and dimensions of it. And a number of Soto monks were right in the midst of that process. And when they went to China in the early 1300s, they found some great teachers. In the middle of the page here in bold, you see there's a guy named Gulin, and a guy a monk named Zhongfang. These were famous Chinese monks who taught poetry as a form of meditation, or something conducive to meditation, and it's something that's enhanced by meditation, to Japanese students who flocked to study with them for several decades in the early 1300s. And some of those included Soto monks. They didn't only teach poetry. They taught. They gave out transmission certificates. They taught calligraphy, how to comment on koan stories, how to interpret and read sutras. How they taught different printing techniques because China was more advanced in printing than Japan at the time. What kinds of paper to use? They taught how to publish and distribute a lot of these books. And it was a whole creative industry revolving around Zen literature and the arts. Now, again, this picture got very compressed, but this is a calligraphy that the monk named Gulin wrote to one of his Japanese followers, whose name was Getsulin. And those are the two big, bold characters. It literally means moon and forest. Getsulin means moon and forest. And then he has those characters quite bold, and then you can see there's a poem written in very tiny characters right after that. And then we can imagine that Gulin gave this to Getsulin, and then Getsulin takes this back very proudly to Japan. And then, you know, he starts teaching that style of poetry to his followers in Japan. You know, there's a list of names here. You won't be tested on them. But what I want to say with some of these names listed in capital letters on the bottom half of page 3 is that this is a list of primarily of Soto school monks. Some were Chinese coming to Japan. Some were Japanese going to China, who were involved in the writing of this kind of poetry. And so on page 4, we have some examples of those poems. Now, I want to point out that that Gu Lin, once again, was one of the famous Chinese teachers who never went to China, but apparently had dozens and dozens of he never went to Japan, but he had dozens of Japanese students come to study with him. Betsugen, Taichi were Soto monks from Japan, like three generations after Dogen, who went to study with Gu Lin in China and then came back to Japan after like 15 or 20 years and continued to write poetry. Giyun was one of the monks who did not go to China, but studied Hongzhi, studied, of course, Dogen's writings, studied Hongzhi's writings, studied the writings that were being brought from China, and learned how to write Chinese poetry well enough that he was, you know, he's gained quite a reputation. So let's look at the poem by Taichi, who, a Soto monk who went to China, came back to Japan, and this, and then he lived far away from Eheiji. Apparently he visited Eheiji, and at that time, Dogen Shobogenzo was not being sold or not being distributed outside of Eheiji. So you could study it if you went to Eheiji, but they didn't want copies sent out. But apparently, because Taichi was thought very highly by his by one of the teachers at Eheiji, they did allow him to get a copy. And this poem is written kind of celebrating the day that he received the copy of the Shobogenzo. So who would like to read that poem by Taichi? Okay.
The enlightened mind, the treasury of the true Dharma eye, touches us, teaches us the innermost thoughts of the 33 ancestors, a mystical path from Kichijo reaches all the way to my tiny Kyushu village, where I see anew an ethereal mist rising from the remarkable shoot.
Okay, great. All right, so now is this excellent poetry as poetry? You know, again, that's a hard judgment to make, but let's look at it for its spiritual significance. Let's look at it as a Zen saying. The first sentence tells us the title of the Shobogenzo, the treasury of the true Dharma eye, and kind of the subtitle is the mind of enlightenment or the mind of nirvana. This captures the innermost thoughts of the 33 ancestors. The 33 ancestors go from 28 from Shakyamuni Buddha in India to Bodhidharma, who then transmits Zen to Japan, and there were six main ancestors in Japan, in China, and so that for a total of 33, because 28 plus 6, but Bodhidharma overlaps. So the mystical path from Kichijo, which was the name of the mountain that Eheiji was located on, reaches all the way to my tiny village in Kyushu, which is the southern island of Japan, very far distant away. This was a time when, you know, we look back on it, and again, Shobogenzo was not being distributed outside of Eheiji for the most part, but apparently Taichi was able to get this copy. So we can imagine the feeling to have it in his hands, and now he can read it and study it and start teaching it to his students. And then what do we make of the final line of this poem? Right, growing, right? Okay, yeah, I mean, right, it might just be a description of nature, but it becomes a kind of inspirational statement about, oh, now's the opportunity to implant the Dharma and it can grow in this new area, just as it's been spreading so far from India to China, China to Japan, from northern Japan to southern Japan.
it's going to be so far away, because I know the future is really far.
It's really far, yeah.
Especially
yeah.
in that
yeah.
time.
Right.
It was warlord, so there's not...
Exactly, yeah, yeah, period. That's right.
To bring this back to future, that's the roots, the shoots that are coming out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
And the ethereal mist is the attainment
the That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I like the way you're putting it there, and you can feel that. You know, you're getting across that excitement that he must have felt that he's got this in his hands, and now he can study it. So the words and letters are important because this captures, the Shobo Genzo means it's a repository of Dogen's insights into the wisdom of the ancestors. Okinawa, not. Because Okinawa, Kyushu was remote, but Kyushu was the place where the boats departed to go to China. You know, if you look at the map, Kyushu was the southernmost island, the closest to China. So, actually, Zen, probably the first Zen temple in Japan was actually in Kyushu because, the guy before Dogen, Eisai, who went to China and brought Zen back, landed in Kyushu, and everybody landed in Kyushu, but actually Taichi was from Kyushu, so he didn't just land there and go through it. He stayed there and built his temple there. Unfortunately, I just heard a terrible story that I didn't realize this, but remember there was an earthquake in Kyushu a couple of years ago, a very devastating earthquake, and apparently it destroyed Taichi's temple, including some of the archives. So that's a very sad story, but that's part of the nature as well. Okay, now let's look at Gion. Gion became the fifth abbot of Eheiji. So he was kind of in the mainstream there. He was considered an expert in the five ranks, and he taught that system and the writing of poetry to both Soto and Rinzai monks at the time. There was a lot of interaction between all these people who were excited about using poetry to spread the Dharma. And Gion wrote a collection of poems commenting on the Shobo Genzo. This was produced in 1329. It was revered quite a bit, and it was considered so powerful in the Soto tradition for a number of years that people said, like, well, nobody else should try to write a commentary on the Shobo Genzo after Gion, because how can you top Gion? And it had a kind of authoritative tone to it, for better or worse, until the 1700s when it took about 400 years before there were new efforts to comment on the Shobo Genzo. The poem at the bottom is on one of the famous fascicles called the Genjo Koan fascicle, realizing the enlightenment, realizing the koan in everyday life, or enlightenment realized here and now. You can translate it in different ways. And there's quite a few English translations of Genjo Koan. First, there's a capping phrase, and then there's a four-line poem. So let's take the capping phrase. Let's all read the capping phrase. Okay, so why do I put in parentheses, or this is it?
Because what is it?
This is it. Yeah. Because Dogen makes that wordplay when he talks about, in many other examples of koans that he interprets, where something that looks grammatically like a question. Remember, there were no question marks in Chinese or Japanese. Right? So you only had the words. So if you look at the printed page, you know, it's a context that tells you, a question mark doesn't leap out. Hey, this is a question. But what Dogen wants to say is anything that looks like a question could be a statement. So that's why I don't know which way to translate it. I'd rather not have a second thing in parentheses. I'd rather just pick one or the other, but I'm afraid if you pick this is it, it's not, maybe that's Dogen's point, but it's not grammatically. So how many people vote for using this is it? Well, Taigen, you outrank everybody, so...
I was going to vote for the other one, too.
Okay. Right. So how many people... What's that? Yeah, just this is it. There we go. Okay. All right. So solved. All right. Now, please, someone read the poem.
Do not overlook that which is right in front of you, the endless spring of years with early plum blossoms. Using a single word, you can enter the open gate. Nine oxen pulling with all their might cannot lead you astray.
Okay. So let's take it line by line. What's the first line? Don't miss out. It's right in front of you. So Genjo Koan, this is it.
Genjo Koan says, here is the way in, the place in the post.
Right. And I want to flip for a minute to a poem on page 2. By Muso Soseki, who was a contemporary of Gion, also did not go to China, but wrote Chinese poetry, and was probably the most famous monk of that time of the Rinzai school in Kyoto. And he says, autumn-colored word branches dropping many leaves, frosty clouds carrying rain, passing this nook in the mountains. There's the rain once again. Everyone is born with the same sort of eyes. Why don't they see the koan that is right in... Well, you know, you could translate in this different ways. Why don't they see the koan? Why can't we see the koan? Another translation could be, why am I the only one to see the koan? But it makes a very similar point. Another stereotype that gets... dropped here is that Genjo Koan is often considered to be kind of unique to Dogen, but it was actually a term that was used quite a bit in by other Zen writers at the time, sometimes in a similar way. Okay, so the koan is right here. We just don't always recognize that it's a koan. The endless spring appears with the early plum blossoms. Well, this is very, very typical Dogen. You know, in China and Japan, just as the snow is ending in late February, the first flowers that come out are plum blossoms. Dogen has a whole chapter called Plum Blossoms on the symbolism. So that's the sign of renewal. In the deepest winter, the spring is about to burst forth. And that renewal is going to take place every year. Okay, line 3. Pardon me?
You can enter into life, but not just life, but enlightenment.
You can enter the gate to enlightenment with one word.
Is it one or is it this?
Well, ask Ty again. That's right. It's got to be the word that has the right that makes the right mistake. And once you're entering, then the oxen can pull you away because your momentum is so powerful. Time? Okay, so let me go back to... we can't end without Dogen, so let me go back to one more poem by Dogen, and let's go back to page 2. The next to last one that begins for half a year. So, again, a historical context. Apparently, when Dogen was at Heiji, at one point, the new shogun, who was located in a town called Kamakura, invited Dogen to visit, and he spent 6 months there teaching the shogun. The shogun was a meditator. We know historically he was a meditator, and we know that he built his big Zen temple. Called Kanchoji Temple. We're not 100% sure if the story is true that he offered it to Dogen, but the legend is that Dogen was offered this and decided, no, I don't want to spend my time with the shogun. I'm going to go back to Heiji. And so the temple was given to a Chinese monk who had come to visit Japan around the same time. And so Dogen is facing this turning point. Should he stay in Kamakura and take the new temple, or should he return? So he says, for half a year I have taken my rice in the home of a layman. Now, I could give you a little more background there, but what do you think that means? Was he happy with that? No, because he was with some, you know, he was forced into a semi-secular existence.
But also he's with the military ruler.
And he's with the military ruler.
Slave people.
Yes, exactly. And repented for it, but he still had a history of 45 years of you know, committing violent acts one after another. So Dogen decided that's not for me. And, you know, he makes this kind of ironic comment that I think it is kind of funny. You know, I've taken my rice in the home of a layman. How disgusting can you get? There's the tree, the plum blossom once again. And in the early spring, and this is in China, in the Sino-Japanese, this is an onomatopoeia, the third line, because it means, you know, the bang and the boom sound of the thunder. Now I have the translation. I've been thinking about this in Kyoto, but actually, I think. Well, it means emperor's town, literally, and the point is that he wants to go back to Eheiji. And Eheiji, and that's in the side of the country near Kyoto, has will soon have the red peach blossoms. So, then we're going to have some Q&A, right? A little bit of time. Okay, so my final point is that in all of these poems, I think we can see that creative tension of Dogen. It's not always the same tension. One tension is about the emotions. One tension is about writing. One tension is about the shogun. One tension is about, you know, the mountains. One tension is about your teaching. But the poetry is a great vehicle, in my opinion, to get across that issue. So, thank you.
So we're a little late, but still, with Stephen here, I want people to have a chance to ask questions or make comments on this, or while we have the opportunity with Stephen here, if you have other questions about it, again, please feel free. So, any comments or questions?
Yeah. Okay, please. Thanks. Right.
So would you mind reading it to us in Japanese?
Oh, okay. Well, you know, it's a very archaic pronunciation. These are very unusual characters. So I would actually, you know, would have transcribed that like I did with some of the other poems before then. But those last three characters, if you look at it literally, what happens with a lot of these seven character lines is, one of the rules is that there is a break. There's kind of a pause. Usually four and then three. So you have a phrase of four characters and then you have a phrase of three characters. Sometimes it's 3-4, but usually it's 4-3. So the last three characters are the onomatopoeia. And, the first three characters are, refer to the, coming out of the slumber. You know, it's if you think, you know, there's a famous line in Western philosophy, I think by Kant, that we were that he was saying Western philosophy through the medieval period had been in a kind of philosophical slumber, right? Because they hadn't really challenged critically the church teachings and they just took everything for granted. And I think there's a little bit of that flavor here. Like, all of a sudden he's being brought back to his right mind, which is like, I can't just sit here with the shogun, you know, and maintain my religious purity. So I have to make this decision, even though there's going to be repercussions. You know, Dogen was supported at Heiji by a samurai patron. And the samurai patron probably wanted Dogen to stay with the shogun, and because that was going to be good for his daimyo-ship up in that part of Japan. But Dogen made that decision to change. There was a recent film in 2009 that's been distributed in the U.S. called Zen, and it's basically the life of Dogen. A lot of it's fabricated. Did anybody get a chance to see that? It's just called Zen in English. Yeah, and you know, it's pretty available. And there was a famous kabuki actor who played Dogen in that movie, and I think he does a really great job, especially in that scene. Comes obviously towards the end of the movie, and the actor, you know, the shogun's asking him one more time, "Aren't you going to stay?" And he, you know, he just says, you know, "No way," and takes off, and then his samurai stays with the shogun, according to the movie version. You know, we don't quite know what happened historically. In another legend connected with this, and this has been carried out in some kabuki plays, the shogun was so upset with Dogen that he took his sword to cut off his neck as Dogen was sitting in meditation. But the power of Dogen's meditation broke the sword in half. And the shogun let him go. So there's different versions of it, but it's a very powerful story. Yeah.
I find it interesting that there is this divide between Rensai poetry and Soto poetry.
Yeah.
Soto kind of gets the trend of the scholarship chat.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, that stereotype just played right out. So if you look at the collections of that poetry, and you know, you go to the Japanese library, and there's a 12-volume collection, and there's a, you know, another 20-volume collection, and it's, you know, 98% is Rinzai. It's true. But you know, they usually do have a couple Dogen poems in there, including that Fukakusa one. That's the one that is almost always included. And maybe a couple of these other ones are included sometimes from Dogen. But when you start looking at it carefully, you realize that, hey, that monk Taichi and Gion and some of those monks got thrown in there. And, you know, what people forgot about was that they weren't Rinzai monks. They were actually Soto monks. So then the percentage goes up somewhat when you look at it that way. But the collectors and the intellectuals who were studying it generally are from the Rinzai side. So, you know, we were talking, there's a great book on this era that was written in 1993 by William Botiford. I don't know if anybody's seen that book, Soto Zen in Medieval Japan. You know, it's a wonderful book. I've read it dozens of times. I always go back to that book. It's like I put it under my pillow and hope that I can absorb the ideas. And William Botiford is a wonderful professor at UCLA. So I don't want to sound critical, and he wrote this 25 years ago, but if you look at that book, like, he doesn't mention the word wanshiha a single time in that. But I went back and looked and said, what did Botiford say about it? I realized he hadn't even mentioned it, because it even though he covers so many other points from that era, it just completely dropped out of the picture. But, you know, I think in any, you know, field, any academic field or any kind of research we're doing, you know, we're sort of looking for the black holes. What's been left out? What hasn't been touched on yet? And this is one of many areas like that we can develop further in you know, more studies, and hopefully more translations come out.
Something adjacent to
it. Yeah.
Struck me a little bit. Is there, how much competition was there in a sense of the country bumpkins from?
Yeah.
The rural part, you know, which they used to call the Ura Nihon, you know, the part that's forgotten, the backside.
That's right. The flyover states, right?
Versus
the... Is Illinois a flyover state, or... I don't know.
No, I'm here.
All right. But,
Kyoto,
yes,
especially calligraphy, how it becomes such a sign of status.
Yeah.
Your calligraphy was good because you were a wealthy and enlightened
and well-educated, and you had been trained in it from a little kid, because you had to have that ability to be creative eventually. You know, like Mozart was writing symphonies at age 4. I mean, there were a lot of prodigies. Dogen himself was probably a prodigy, and he did some of this, some of his reading and writing from an early age. Yeah, I mean, that's it. And you know, like any stereotype, there is some truth to it. But but in that medieval period, you know, a lot of it got created later. So, you know, history books are always written after. Well, I mean, when you go back to history from 1300s, we're not. What am I trying to say? A very simple point, which is that a lot of the stereotypes that are associated with that period, the stereotypes were created at a later period. But then they become so entrenched by today. So let's say in the 1600s, 1700s, then they started creating these stereotypes because this was the Edo period in Japan, and the shogun was even more forceful and very, very, you know, what the shogun was saying to all religious groups, especially Buddhists, in the 1600s, 1700s, the shogun was saying, like, okay, what does your school do? Why do we need you? And you'd say, like, oh, we write poetry. And then he'd say, okay, what does your school do? And if you said, well, we write poetry, he'd say, well, we don't need you. We already have these guys writing poetry. So we're going to merge you in. So then the Soto people want to say, no, we don't write poetry. You know, we do country bumpkin things. Well, good country bumpkin things are we help the farmers build bridges. You know, we help them build irrigation canals. So that's our thing. And then that gets recorded in the history book, 1600s and 1700s. By the time we're reading it, we think, oh, that must have been what it was. But that was reacting to a whole, you know, a half millennium later, basically.